And right now, let's get back to that attack on the U.S. embassy in Damascus. At a news conference in Nova Scotia today, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice praised Syrian security agents for their part in stopping the assault.
I think it's very early to try and speculate on why this might have happened and what it means for Syria. I just want to underscore again that we appreciate the response of the Syrian security forces.
Unusual words of praise from Washington in what's been an otherwise chilly relationship with Syria of late. In the attack, four men shouting what were reported to be Islamic slogans tried to storm and blow up the embassy with hand grenades. They were also armed with automatic rifles and a vehicle rigged with explosives which failed to explode. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack. It was an unusual occurrence in Syria, whose government is stridently secular and where police state control has effectively quelled most radical violence. Joining us now to talk more about the context of this incident is Michael Slackman. He's Cairo bureau chief for the New York Times, and he joins us now from his home in Cairo. Nice to have you on the program again.
Nice to be here.
Just in June, Syrian police had a gun battle with Islamic militants near the defense ministry. Now this, are we seeing signs that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad might be losing his grip a bit?
Well, I don't know that we can go that far based on those incidents. But clearly what we're seeing is a rise in the type of Takfiri jihadist activity that the regime under Bashar al-Assad has tried to prevent. And it's a worrisome trend, but not only in Syria, throughout the region.
Takfiri is a word many people will be unfamiliar with.
Well, it's one of the more extremist elements within the among Islamists. And what it effectively is a group of people who believe they have the justification to go out and kill, not only kill foreigners, but kill Muslims as well.
Mm-hmm. Is there a disconnect to some degree now between the secular government of the Ba'ath Party that rules Syria and the dynasty, now the second al-Assad in charge there, and what we believe to be an increasingly religious public?
I mean, even under Hafez Assad, he played to the religious community within Syria. He was very well known for building mosques. It's true, he also violently crushed the Muslim Brotherhood. This regime has done pretty much the same thing, but in recent months, has actually stepped up its efforts to appease the religious community. If you listen carefully to Bashar Assad's comments, his speeches, he's actually made reference to religious identity. The regime, the government of Bashar Assad, has done things to appease the religious community, recognizing that religiosity is on the rise. Again, not only in Syria, but throughout the region. But I think you have to be careful, Neil, not to just look at things in isolation. You also have a situation in Syria where there's tremendous anti-American sentiment as a result of what happened in Lebanon. I'm not saying that these are linked, but I think it's necessary always to look at the big picture.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, some might be forgiven for at least passing the thought through their heads that an attack on the U.S. embassy in Damascus, maybe some people in power may have known about this.
I think when you're talking about Syria, there's always going to be elements of conspiracy theories. We don't really know how decisions are made at the top. We don't really have a sense for to what extent is Bashar Assad really calling the shots. Or are there folks from the old guard, from his father's regime, who are calling the shots? We do know that the regime is under tremendous pressure, that it certainly has been under tremendous pressure from the United States and the international community for harboring Hamas or the militant wing of Hamas, Khaled Mashal, for alleged connection to the murder of Rafiq Hariri, and more recently for its very close and tightening relations with Iran.
Describe for us the neighborhood where this happened. The diplomatic quarter, as I understand it, is closely guarded.
It would be a very difficult place to pull off an operation like this. I mean, the U.S. Embassy is a virtual fortress up on a hill, surrounded by police and soldiers all the time.
And indeed, there are other embassies in quite close to it, and they are also well guarded.
The city of Damascus is well guarded because there are undercover police everywhere, police policing the police. In this region, in this section of the city, it's even more so because in addition to the undercover security, you have the military on the streets.
And this
big wall. The embassy is surrounded by a huge wall.
And this is the same part of the city where many government officials have their homes.
I'm not aware of that. I don't know where the government officials live, but it's a upscale, wealthy kind of leading up into the hills, very well, you know, leafy neighborhood with big houses and big buildings. The British Embassy is not far away.
As you think about the implications of this, perhaps we're reading too much into say that it's anti-Syrian in a way as a challenge to the regime as well as obviously a manifestation of anti-Americanism.
It is to some extent a challenge to the government in that one of the things that Syria has prided itself on is that it is very stable. I mean, you can criticize the method by which they have achieved stability, but domestically, in recent years, it's been stable. And that's something that the regime has been trying to achieve both through a heavy hand in security by locking up, you know, people who would speak against them, people who would criticize them, and by appeasing the religious folks. This is an embarrassment to them.
You mentioned the history a little bit, Bashar al-Assad's father, Hafez al-Assad, and his, well, battles is not too strong a word to use with the Muslim Brotherhood.
No, he wiped out the city of Hama. I mean, the estimates are that he killed as many as 40,000 people when he sent tanks into Hama to crush the Muslim Brotherhood. I think one of the things that Western diplomats and Syrian analysts have told me is it would be very difficult, given the police state nature of Syria, for an organization to actually have a structure similar to the Muslim Brotherhood, say, in Egypt, in Syria today. That said, some of the analysts I spoke to in Syria today said this seemed like a relatively sophisticated operation with hand grenades, automatic weapons, and car bombs.
So even a cellular structure, which the Muslim Brotherhood has used in other parts of the world, that would be difficult in Syria today?
That is what's been explained to me, yeah. I spoke to one Western diplomat, European diplomat, some months ago, who said that they were in the process of monitoring these jihadi websites that are used by people who are Osama bin Laden-minded, not necessarily his followers, but people ideologically aligned with them. And the debate, as this diplomat told me on the website, was whether or not to try to activate within Syria. In other words, begin pulling off military operations, as we've seen in places like Egypt and Jordan. And at the time, what he said was they decided they would not do it in Syria, partly because they were too weak and they'd be crushed. Now we're beginning to see some steps forward in that direction.
Explain to me, if you can, how a government which has had its own problems with the Muslim Brotherhood and which has cracked down, as you've described, on them in the past and which employs all of these secret police to make sure that nobody can have a structure to do any of this, at the same time the Syrian government supports what many in the rest of the world describe as terrorists, Hezbollah and Hamas, the most militant wing of Hamas?
Well, you're getting into a slightly different area and something that's very complicated, technical, and emotional. I think what the Syrians would say is they defined Hezbollah and Hamas not as terrorist organizations, but as liberation organizations. This is not what I'm saying, but I'm saying this is what they would argue. Certainly within Lebanon, the Lebanese government and at least a large percentage of the Lebanese people don't see Hezbollah as a terrorist organization, but as the liberation organization that pushed Israel out of southern Lebanon. And herein lies one of the biggest problems in the so-called war on terror, defining who the enemy is.
And this goes back a very long way. A lot of Palestinian factions for many, many years, including aspects of the PLO at various times, have had their headquarters in Damascus.
Well, that's true. And I think you said earlier that this was a stridently secular government. I don't know that that's true anymore. It still does pride itself on the Ba'athist ideology of pan-Arabism. And what they will argue is the PFLP and other Palestinian organizations, they have to be given a right to stay in Damascus, and they feel that it's their duty as part of the kind of like national charter. Maybe it's cover, maybe it's political, you know, talk. But this is what they will argue, that as a pan-Arab state and the leader of pan-Arabism and the only surviving leadership of pan-Arabism, they need to let these organizations stay there.
One final question, and that is based on your experience. How much are we likely to hear about the organization that carried out this attack?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, how much are we going to hear about it? Depends in part on whether or not the Syrian government thinks putting information out will serve its interests.
Michael Slackman, thanks very much. We appreciate your time.
Thanks very much.
Michael Slackman, Cairo bureau chief for the New York Times, and he joined us today from his home in Cairo, Egypt. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.